So I am going to actually talk about that large set of things, and they're all closely related, is the reason why. And they all are, we're increasingly recognizing they're in the area of moduli phenomenology. These are things that we learned by actually constructing a definite model, one that a lot of you know we've worked on, the M-theory compactified on a G2 manifold. It's a very concrete model where we can calculate many things, all the moduli, VEVs, and masses, and interactions. We stabilize all the moduli in this. And it's an existence proof for the kinds of things I'm going to talk about. But now we've recognized that a lot of things that we didn't anticipate happen, and so we've learned that we can generalize them to many areas of, many corners of string theory, and that they're very generic in ways that we didn't realize at all. Stabilizing the moduli is essential to see all these connections to these other areas of physics. And so any approach which doesn't actually stabilize the moduli can't really see these in a definite way. Also, a lot of the individual points that I'll make are known to some people in some ways, but in this talk and in the work we're doing, we're tying them together with some new implications that we didn't anticipate. So one way of doing it is to remind you that there's something that's known to a certain number of people in various ways, but not widely known, that is probably a very broadly valid thing in a four-dimensional supergravity vacuum that comes from string or M theories with various qualifications. There will exist at least one modulus field, and probably many, whose mass is of order m3/2. And that has huge implications that are not normally recognized. So what I'm going to do, the way I decided to present it, is first to talk about the implications, because they're largely new and they're important implications, and then sketch briefly the arguments for why the conjecture is very generally true. The papers that have looked at this kind of statement about the moduli are a set of papers by Jan Lully and Claudio Struccia and collaborators, the last of which is here, and there's five or six papers over 5 years or so that look at it. They were mostly interested in questions about vacuum stability, but they were aware of the fact that there's the lowest eigenvalue of the moduli mass matrix that's around m3/2, but don't focus on it or make it very explicit. So this is the best literature we're aware of to approach this, and I'll just cast it slightly in a form that that we are using. First, I want to emphasize some of the dangers of having moduli that are light. By light, I mean of order m3/2 in any theory. So these are things that are known to many of you in terms of the moduli problem and the gravitino problem issues. After the end of inflation, the moduli begin to oscillate at some point when the Hubble parameter is of order their mass, and the energy density is of order m3s squared and Planck squared. If you track then by forming the ratio of the energy density to the entropy, which should be more or less constant as the universe cools, that's proportional to the temperature, which in the usual framework is that square root and a fairly large number. But today the energy density over the entropy is small. So if moduli were hanging around today, then they would entirely dominate the situation, and it would be disastrous from the point of view of agreeing with cosmology. So they have to decay before about 10 to the minus 2 seconds. If it's not before that, then they destroy BBN successes. And that corresponds to a moduli mass of order 30 TeV with factors of 2 depending on the theory being possible, that gives about that lifetime. So moduli basically have to be heavier than about 30 TeV, and keep that in mind. The only known way out of this is to have a late inflation, which dilutes them. And if you can, of course, put late inflation in arbitrarily by hand, even though it's not in your theory. But if you look for it to be in the theory, that's a strong constraint, because there's not normally a way to get late inflation in string-based theories. So, but it is, if you had a late inflation, it would be a way of solving that problem. So you're led then to the idea that the cosmological history of the universe is non-thermal because of the moduli. The moduli then are oscillating, dominating after inflation. The moduli coupled universally with decay widths, they couple gravitationally with decay widths that generically have that form. That's the effective operator for the decay. The coefficients are of order one, and they really are, and they're calculable in any definite theory to some approximation factor of two level. And you find then connecting the masses that the moduli decay of order 10 to the minus 2 or 3 seconds, and the temperature that would, if you look at the temperature that would you would define as a reheat temperature, or the temperature corresponding to their decay width, it's of order 5, 10, 15, 20 MeV with a little model dependence, but quite generic. The moduli couple to every gravitationally to every standard model particle and superpartner. So in particular, they produce a lot of entropy when they decay. They dilute any previous relic density you got by a freeze-out. And in their decay, the branching ratio of moduli to superpartners is around a quarter, and every superpartner gives a lightest superpartner. So if that's the dark matter, then about one quarter of all the moduli decays give you that. If you work it through, and as I said, all these calculations are done concretely for the example where we've quantified everything, and you can check it there, but it's very general that you will get a lot of superpartners, and then they have to annihilate with the appropriate Boltzmann equations. And you actually get a non-thermal whip miracle that the number of LSPs, because this is the solution of the Boltzmann equations, is again the Hubble parameter over the annihilation cross-section. You do not lose the so-called Wimp miracle in this non-thermal cosmological history, but the Hubble parameter is evaluated at the moduli decay temperature rather than at the thermal freeze-out temperature. So it remains conceptually an attractive thing that the dark matter is related to a cosmological quantity divided by the particle physics annihilation cross-section. In the G2 example, you get about the right relic density if the annihilation cross-section is about 10 to the minus 24 square centimeters, which implies a Wino-like lightest superpartner, which has that annihilation cross-section in supersymmetry. MC has is about 30 TeV for the whole, for everything that I talk about, yeah, typically. If you do it in any, if you have moduli with that sort of mass in any theory, you'll get this answer. Yeah. The G2 is just a case where you can work out all the calculations in great detail and see that you're not making assumptions that could be inconsistent or something. You got the whole picture, and so it's kind of an existence proof that it can be done. But it's fine in any theory with moduli masses of that order. Then you get the non-thermal history, and you get this large cross-section. People have usually taken, say, a Beano-like LSP with a cross-section for annihilation about 100 times smaller than that, and then you don't get the right answers. So one of the points I'm making then is that this non-thermal cosmological history is very robust and generic and important for connecting to the lightest superpartner and the dark matter. There's also an upper limit, which is seldom recognized on M3 halves. So the lower limit is effectively coming from decaying before BBN and not dominating cosmologically after that. The upper limit can be stated various ways, but one way is that in any theory, you can calculate the relic density. There's a familiar kind of formula with the mass of the LSP and 1 over the cross-section of it. And the cross-section goes like 1 over the annihilating mass squared. And then there's always a factor like this that's the moduli mass to the 3s power. And again, this formula is derived in our concrete calculations, but it'll be true in any theory where you calculate the relic density from moduli decaying into superpartners and then solve the Boltzmann equations to let them annihilate down. Well, if you have a Planck scale gravitational mass, nothing occurs at low anything, and so you don't have any problem with anything. You also don't have any phenomena.
So there's like another perfect window.
There's an upper limit on M3 halves if you want to tie onto the physics. The point here is that the relic density grows like the 3/2 power of the gravitational mass. And so if the gravitational mass is bigger than a few hundred TeV, then you overclose the universe in all theories.
Right, but then there's another window where the gravitational mass is bigger than...
There isn't if you have a light a superpartner that's coming from it, then this is it. But if you have all particles at the high scale and nothing at the low scale, that's different. So there's both a lower and an upper limit on M3 halves to have consistency with qualitative data about the real world that will be true in essentially any string theory that connects to the world. Now you can ask questions like, could the moduli reheat temperature get you above the thermal freeze-out temperature so the thermal history takes over? And you can go through several questions like that. The answer is always no. We've checked all those kinds of ways out, and they don't work in practice when you look typically because of the 3/2 power that things grow as, for example, it's still small in this case. So I won't go through all the kind of caveats. So you end up with a kind of very general, very generic picture. There's a non-thermal cosmological history arising because of the moduli. If you have string-based models for TeV physics with stabilized moduli of order 3/2, they will always give that, always generically. They will then give you a Wino-like light a superpartner to have the relic density right. They will include the normal Wnt miracle. Remembering that different LSPs have very different annihilation rates and interactions, then connecting to the rest of data is relevant. And I'll show you in a couple minutes that this, in addition, does give a correct description of the Pamela data and is testable at LHC. I won't focus on the LHC part here, but we know how to test it several ways there. But this picture, I think, is very, we're becoming convinced it's very broad and general in many areas of string theory, not just where we've calculated it. I didn't say anything here. You can calculate it, for example, the way that seems likely to work best, and it's mentioned in Piyush's papers, is that the initial baryon asymmetry is order 1, and then the entropy produced in the moduli decays can reduce it down to a reasonable number. So we have not done that calculation quantitatively and properly yet, but it looks like qualitatively like that works. And there are other possible things to try, but that's the one that we'll certainly try and settle on first. So you need an initial baryon asymmetry of order 1, and then it all follows quickly. There's some more general consequences that come out of this whole picture implied again from the string level. The axion relic abundance is diluted by the entropy from the moduli decay, and I'm not going to mention that again, but Piyush Kumar's talk in a little while will focus on that and show how that alleviates some of the problems with axions in string theory and generally allows a solution of the strong CP problem and a satisfactory set of axion things. Another point is that generically and all superpartner masses will be of order M3/2 in string theories. And so you wouldn't expect to see a whole lot of colliders. But in in our G2 case and in many examples, it's shown up in heterotic cases and in type 2 cases. Typically, the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking among the various ones that come in that gives the largest positive F terms and gives you a de Sitter vacuum. For example, in one of our versions, it came from a hidden sector chiral matter that gave positive F terms. And later this afternoon, Torabian's talk has it coming from Yukawa coupling of scalars that don't carry gauge quantum numbers. And it's a very robust thing that that doesn't couple to the gauge enos at the tree level, and therefore, and the gauge enos, you know, vanish in the supersymmetry limit. So the gauge enos are suppressed compared to the 30 GeV and will give you gluenos and LSPs of order hundreds of GeV when you work out what the typical suppression is. But there's a lower limit also because there's always an anomaly contribution you can't get rid of that gauge eno masses have. So you have to have all that taken into account. And your typical spectrum in all kinds of these kinds of theories will be heavy scalars and light gauge enos. And that's the most generic kind of spectrum you can find from string theories. Also, an important point, if you try and have a theory that break supersymmetry with gauge mediation, then, and you have try and have that at lower scales instead of all at the string scale, then you know you get a small gravitino mass, and then the moduli at that gravitino mass will have energy densities that dominate the universe. You can work out that the associated temperatures are many GeV, whereas the experimental temperatures are in the electron volt region. And so those theories will simply be excluded if you include, if you actually examine the moduli that go with it. You will not have things like low-scale gauge mediation or any theory with a light gravitino. Possibly, it will not be possible for it to be a major source of supersymmetry breaking in string theory. You can ask questions like, could there be corrections from the messenger sector, but those don't in fact couple to the moduli generically, and they won't change the fact that it's of order the gravitino mass. Or you can ask, could the universe be reheated enough when the moduli do decay to get you back to a reasonable situation? And the answer is generically no. Again, so that whole kind of approach is not going to occur in general generic string theories. Now let me just say a few words about why it'll actually be correct that there'll always be a modulus of order M3 halves. The first reason is that in all the examples anyone's calculated so far, it's come out. But in many cases, people don't actually do that calculation. So more generally, I'm not going through a lot of details, but take some of the standard equations for the mass squared matrix of moduli from the papers of Jan Louis and Claudio Struccia and collaborators. Most of these terms actually vanish at the minimum, but whatever they are, put them in there. Project along the super Goldsteiner direction, the scalar, the complex scalar, and you get a 2x2 mass matrix for it. You have the appropriate Riemann tensor from the full moduli space and the curvature piece. And then you just notice one of the standard results that if you have a large positive definite mass matrix, then the smallest eigenvalue of that is bounded by the smaller eigenvalue of any 2x2 submatrix of it. And you can see that all of those are proportional to M3 halves. And that basically is what's happening that gives you the theorem in very general situations. So NR has to be negative for stability.
Most examples,
that's fine. That's fine. That's consistent. Well, in the G2 case, we do get the same order, and in some other cases, I don't mind if it's suppressed. That still says what we're doing is valid. So this needs. It would be nice to work it out in a large number of cases, or try and make an even better theorem, which we're trying to do but haven't done. But it's a bound, and if it's smaller, then there's some danger that you have to check. If it's really of order M3 halves, and that's in the 30 TeV at the factor of 2 level, then you're technically safe, as far as I know, from all these kinds of constraints. So we're pursuing trying to do a better job on the supergravity structure of this and pin it down carefully, but that's more or less the believability at this level. Now, for completeness, when I'm in different places around the world or different communities, people, there's many misstatements about the WINO LSP or WINO-like LSP describing the Pamela data. So I'm just going to take a minute and show you that, in fact, that is the case, to make sure no one's confused about it. So this is the Pamela data, the red error bars for the ratio of positrons to E plus plus E minus versus the energy of the positron. The theory, including fits to the high energy electrons, for the background, including those fits, is this curve. And then when you add the WINO LSP with a mass in for these graphs of 152 GeV, then you get the blue curve, which gives a pretty good description down to 10 GeV, where the solar modulation begins to dominate, and that works fine. The black curve is just what you would see if you didn't include the high energy electrons. I don't know if people here are following this or not, but I'm just mentioning it in case they have questions or are. And this is the injection of high energy astrophysics electrons, which are not coming from LSP annihilation, and from many people have suggested astrophysical sources, and this injection is consistent with those. And that's the description of the data that's pretty satisfactory. And then people worry about, people are confused about the antiprotons. This is the data, antiproton data, and the blue curve is the WINO description of it, which is a pretty good description of it and certainly satisfactory. Says that in the low energy antiprotons, there was also a dark matter signal. And then, I mean, many audiences, I get a question at this point about the boron to carbon ratio, which is a good check of that, because antiprotons are secondary and are affected by this primaries and secondaries. This ratio measures both. And so if you mess it up, you're unlikely to get the antiprotons right. But that's, again, one of the best descriptions of that ratio. So it really is, that kind of data is really consistent with being described by the WINO LSP. So I think the main points are that you don't see most of these results if you don't stabilize moduli and if you don't do it semi-quantitatively. And all these results are connected. The G2 case is just meant as an existence proof where you can write down everything and calculate it. But all the arguments seem to be very general and hold in any theory. The moduli-dominated non-thermal cosmological history is then generic and is connected to get the right relic density with the WINO LSP. And the Pamela data, if it's completely established, as we expect it to be soon, is consistent with being explained by that. And that's testable at LHC as well in ways that we've spelled out. And any theory with gravitinos lighter than tens of TeV is very unlikely to be able to be a major source of supersymmetry breaking and be consistent with the constraints from having this complete picture and the cosmology. Thank you. On M3 halves?
Yeah.
About 450, 500 TeV. That's the sharpest upper bound we can get generally. In a particular theory, it could be a little smaller. But it's about an order, more or less an order of magnitude range from 30 to 500 is allowed with consistency with the full cosmology constraints and all the particle physics constraints and being part of one theory.
Disappeared. What would you say?
If the Pamela data weren't annihilation of dark matter, that would be evidence against the Wien-Olaitis superpartner being correct. Well, from you also need the Wien-01 with its large annihilation cross section to get the relic density correct, to get omega h squared to be of order 0.1. That's part of the same thing, because otherwise, typically, for example, if you have Beano LSPs in most models, not all, they annihilate poorly, and so you overclose the universe badly. Whereas with the Wienos that annihilate well, you get the right relic density coming from. We calculate it from first principles at the string scale and get it within a factor of a few. So these things are tied together. So if the Pamela data is either interpreted as astrophysics or goes away, then this picture would have to change in a significant way. But I don't think you can get rid of the non-thermal histories. It's just that right now it makes a consistent picture with everything. So you'd have to think what data was telling you in that case. But I don't think it's going away, so I don't have to worry about that.
Clarify that last comment. You mean that you can't have a theory with the gravitational mass less than 30 kV, or you can't have a gravitational mass 4 or 5 kV, and be consistent with what?
Some of those earlier sites, just work out the energy density stored in that in the moduli that survived to then, and it's much larger than the energy cosmological moduli problem. If they're in the 4 or 5 TV region, then they're actually decaying during BBN and screwing that up. But if they're much lighter, then they don't decay till much later, and then they simply dominate the universe with energy density in that, and there's no radiation error, and there's nothing that looks like what we live in. So unless you can find an extraordinarily special case that I'm not aware of, it's a general statement that things, sources of supersymmetry breaking that would imply such a light gravitino don't contribute significantly to the main sources of supersymmetry breaking. There are much more important ones, and so the gravitino, so things that would give a light gravitino are dominated by other things that raise its mass.
Thank our speaker again.